afternoon. Today is Thursday, January the 9th, ninth day of the new year. Joining us this afternoon from the island in the middle of Humboldt Bay. You like the way I build up the tension, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So either you're something that lives in the mud, or you're from Woodley Island. We'll just kind of leave the suspense, let it build a little bit more. Reg Kennedy's with us. He is the service hydrologist for the, here it is, giving it all away, the National NOAA and the Weather Service. So, no, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Yes.
Ha! Boy, I guess I must be on the mend. This afternoon, we'll talk a little bit about some of these catchphrases we've been hearing over the last few weeks. Polar vortex. I think the last polar thing I heard was Polar Express. So we'll talk about the differences between that, what the East and the Midwest have been dealing with all the way down to the Gulf Coast, as well as some of the things we've been experiencing here. We'll talk about it when we come back.
At my bank, I feel at home. I'm Trish Greggy of the Journey's End, and my bank is Redwood Capital Bank.
At my bank, hometown banking isn't just something they say, it's how they do business. I'm Kevin McClendon of Georgia's Glass, and my bank is Redwood Capital Bank.
At my bank, we invest in the future of our community every single day. I'm Greg Foster, and my bank is Redwood Capital Bank.
Redwood Capital Bank. Our interest is you. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Time is 3:13. We're back to talk shop this afternoon with Reg Kennedy. Good timing on that one, Damien. Just as you open the break, you make that comment. Dandy, dandy, dandy. Our quote this afternoon, let's see, I got Charles Dickens. Reg, you get the choice here. Charles Dickens or Wendell Phillips.
Let's go with Wendell Phillips.
Oh, you're one of those guys in Jeopardy. Okay. Quote, the best use of laws is to teach men to trample bad laws under their feet. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Gotta like that one. Oh, boy. So I would imagine you and the compadres out there at the weather station or weather service office are probably trying to be positioned as the Shell answer man for the last 10 days. How come? Why not? What's going on? Tell us all you know. Is that fair? A career, and now you're supposed to condense it down into a real quick, 30-second sound bite. What's going on? Come on, Rich, tell me, condense it all down.
That is a challenge, to condense it down, to take all the information and condense it down. But I don't know about the past 10 days or so, but at least the past five, we have been getting a lot of calls and questions about what's going on, especially... Now that we're almost into mid-January, we haven't seen much of any rain. And so really becoming an issue for many people.
I was thinking of the cold that we had had here in December. Unseasonably cold. And then the national scene, all those folks, it's kind of fun to say, huh? East of the Rockies. baby.
Well, if you look back, I'm trying to think back to the weather pattern in early December. We still had our infamous ridge. But it was a little bit further to the west. And so the colder air was able to come over the top of that ridge and down across the Yukon and then down into the Pacific Northwest. So we got our nice cold snap for a few days because of that. If that ridge is a little further east, then we don't get all that cold air. It stays more on the interior part of the Pacific Northwest. But what kind of happened recently in the east, which I'm sure you were headed,
go east, young man. Go east. And yes.
When I first saw that term polar vortex on the internet, I went, uh-oh. I haven't seen that term in many, many years, and probably maybe it was in school. So I don't know who started it. If it was a weather office in the Midwest, well, he's probably wishing he hadn't done that.
Yeah, certainly.
But I don't know where the source was.
So as we look at the jet stream, now there's... We've got a weird example here in the region on the Winchuck River Bridge. Just over the state line, I go back and forth there all the time. A lot of folks go back and forth daily, you know, if they live in Brookings or Harbor and work in Crescent City. The Chetco effect, okay, which is draining out a lot of the heat out of the valley. It's like halfway across the bridge, you hit a wall. And by the time you go the remaining 30 feet of the bridge, it could drop 5 degrees or more. Almost a legitimate wall. The jet stream, is it a wall and you're on one side of it or the other side of it? Is it a zone? How broad is it? So as we see this thing weaving its way around, how direct is that?
I'm not sure if direct would be the word, but it is a,
it's not it's, the word.
It is a band, if you will, in the upper atmosphere of high winds, which are generally developed from the difference between the cold polar air and the warmer air to the south of it, that temperature difference creating the strong band of winds. That's one reason why you don't have the strong jet in the summertime. You don't have that difference in temperature. And so that's kind of separates that from that.
Okay, so how about if I said how specific is it rather than how direct that is, that line of demarcation?
There,
it doesn't seem like
there is no real in the upper atmosphere. There's no real line of it's fades gradually out and weakens. Yes, so there is no
kind of like a sunrise. It just kind of happens. You see it, you know what's happening. But
and then as you get toward the center, the speed increases more rapidly. But there is no, you know, definite end. It just kind of gradually fades out.
Where the airplanes fly at 20,000 to 35,000 feet, the commercial guys.
Mm-hmm.
Do they fly through the jet stream, over it, under it? Where is the jet stream as far as ratio to the ground?
Usually they won't. Typically, I don't see them flying too much right in the middle of it because they get too bumpy, too much turbulence. But if they can catch part of those stronger winds when they're going east, they'll catch that so they get a nice tailwind, and that saves on their jet fuel, and generally is a shorter flying time.
So those guys are kind of paying attention to this.
They pay attention. They try to find the strongest winds without getting into the area of turbulence, which you can get where the stronger winds gets a little bumpy.
KINS, News and Information Times, 319. We'll be back with more from Reg Kennedy.
Now a minute of sunshine for Humboldt. If you've never been to Eureka's Sequoia Park Zoo, or haven't in a long time, you're in for a treat. Eureka is one of the smallest cities in the nation to have a zoo, and quite a zoo it is. It's among the redwood trees and specializes in a variety of small animals. Many exhibits have been updated, with more on the way. A big favorite is the red panda family. If you think of pandas as black and white, big, and chewing on bamboo, think again. Red pandas are small with reddish coats and white faces. Watch them scamper on their trees. The pink flamingo flock will dazzle you as you pass their pond. There are many more zoo pleasures awaiting young and old alike. There's a cafe and gift shop, too. On Wednesdays, all visitors come in at half price. For days and hours, see their website, sequoiaparkzoo.net. Sunshine for Humboldt is a nonprofit civic association dedicated to the people and places that make this a good place to live.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 324. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Reg Kennedy from the Weather Service. Reg, okay, you kind of teased a little bit, polar vortex. I think you're right. Somebody must have decided they were going to use their 5 years in weather school and sound intelligent and wow the news media for the first 3 hours until everybody adopted the phrase. Does that mean the jet stream?
It's related to the jet stream. The polar vortex in of itself is just the vortex. It is a vortex because it's a deep low, the wind swirling around counterclockwise. And it's the strongest in the wintertime, and it's normally up near the poles. And so the poles have the strong winds. And then it's related to the jet stream and the general circulation. As we get into the midwinter, January, like now, you typically would have more westerly flow over the west coast, and then you have this low over the Hudson Bay or Baffin Island in Canada. And so that's kind of your general circulation in January. And that low is tied to the poles. But what can happen, and what happened when, this year, and I think the last time there was a big Arctic outbreak was in 85, is you get this nice strong ridge off our west coast, which pushes warmer air up towards Alaska. Some people may have heard the news saying it was warmer in Alaska than it was in parts of the U.S. That warm, as you push that up in the warm air, it gets up there in the north, and also because if you got more of a north-south flow, your jet stream has weakened, and it can no longer kind of lock in that cold air over the poles. And then, and in response to the warmer air and the ridging, the atmosphere responds. You can think of it as a fluid responding to this push northward. Okay. Something comes southward, and the cold air comes southward into the central and northeast U.S., and we have these Arctic outbreaks. And, of course, depending on the time of year, sometimes they're colder than at other times of the year. And people who live there are kind of used to what they call sometimes the Alberta Clippers, which is an Arctic outbreak, and which happens for sometimes different reasons, just another push of high pressure moving down out of Canada. But you get the stronger outbreaks as kind of response of the warmer air being pushed up into Alaska.
So it's kind of like Jell-O is what you're saying. You push one spot, it's going to push out somewhere else.
Well, I never thought of Jell-O like that as a fluid, but kind of, that's kind of...
Oh, you're not saying some of the Jell-O I've seen then, man.
But yeah,
okay, let's go with pudding then. How's that? Now everybody's seen bad pudding.
It is a response that way, yes.
So in looking at what's going on, the things that struck me as being the curious is how far down, when they were talking about into the orange groves in Florida and down to the Gulf Coast... Huh. That seems like it's a little bit further than what it normally is, but not paying that much attention to it on a regular basis. Okay. You know, we've all heard about running the fans to keep the air moving off the grapes at our area and then off the oranges there. So is this a magnitude, a more significant of magnitude?
Yes, because we had the stronger... ridge, I think we're contributing to that from the west coast, and you had a much weaker of the jet stream, so you had a stronger push from the high pressure there over the Yukon and northern Canada pushing it down. So the normal Arctic outbreaks don't go quite as far south. They don't have a greatest push to push them southward as this one had. So
you mentioned Hudson Bay, and I don't think many of us really comprehend the size of the Great Lakes, let alone Hudson Bay. When those bodies of water cool on the surface, not even necessarily frozen, but they cool down, what does that do to the airflow over them? Does that make it windier, less windy? Because certainly the temperature change has got to have some kind of an impact on some of these winter storms that come through.
As it ices over, then, of course, the surface smooths out, so it would have less effect on the local winds. It probably wouldn't have that much an effect, type thing. There's other things driving the winds. But, I mean, if it was not iced over, you have, then the winds will pick up the waves, the choppy waves, so you could maybe sense you might have a little bit stronger winds because they're not being interfered with by the waves on the water.
You ready for a hanging curveball?
No, but go ahead.
Okay. Here it comes. 3-1 hanging curveball. Can you explain real easily what wind chill is?
Okay. It's basically designed for, looking at your human comfort or danger to animals and humans. It's kind of when the wind blows, you can have increased evaporation from your body or the animal's body, and so it's a measurement of what it would feel like being outside if the it gives a temperature. What it'd be like outside if the wind wasn't still. So if it's like 15 degrees. And then as the wind increases, they say the wind chills down to zero. That's the kind of effect you'd have if there was no wind. It's what it would feel like to your body and how dangerous it would be.
So it's factoring in the evaporation.
It's the fact of evaporation, the cooling of the wind, yes.
It's always been intriguing for me when they say, but it feels like, yeah, what's the difference between minus 20 and minus 27? Cold is cold. I mean, yes. for this simple body.
Right, because I've never lived where it's really cold, but I know of people who have lived in Alaska. And if there's no wind, and it could be like, you know, 15 degrees out, but no wind, they're bundled up, but it doesn't feel real cold to them.
Tri-cold, yeah, I've heard that one too.
You know, well, but if the wind picks up, then yeah, they're
then
miserable.
You're in trouble, yeah.
Yes.
It's 3:30.
Decade of Difference, making a real difference for the future of the North Coast. This is Jim Ritter with Humboldt Live in the Arcata High School Career and College Center. Do you have life and work experiences that could be of benefit to our local youth? We're recruiting community members to mentor and share ideas with our middle and high school students. Please call me at 839-5114 for more information. The Decade of Difference, making a real difference for the future of the North Coast.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 3:35. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Reg Kennedy, the service hydrologist for the National Weather Service out of Woodley Island. What? Is that the Humboldt Bay office? What is the official office? Or do you know?
Which is the National Weather Service office in Eureka.
Eureka, uh-huh. Okay. I wonder if you're in the city limits there.
I always thought we were.
I don't know. Well, the old post office, you certainly were. I don't know. Huh. Interesting. When the office was moved, or the official temperatures went from the top of the post office, the old post office building, out to Woodley Island, I know that there was an awful lot of, what's happening, 3-degree difference, why? When offices change locations, are those allowances made? Do you keep the old meters and the thermometers and, you know, the technical stuff at the former locations? How does that factor in so you don't see a sudden swing one way or the other in average temperatures and things of that nature?
To have that a continuous record of your precipitation or your temperature, they usually will continue taking observations at both sites, the new for precipitation and temperature. I've never had to do this. I'm not sure how long they have to do it. But you're looking to see if there's any differences. If there is a major difference, then you can't continue as one continuous record of observation. And there's also sometimes a limit of how far away you can be and a difference in elevation. Once you exceed those, then it's pretty much automatic. You can't be continuous. But if
so, it's kind of like present value of money. You hedge it, you adjust for it.
If you're within a tolerance, and then you continue your Peter record instead of starting over again, yes.
Yeah. It's like Bonds' home run record, right? Big asterisk after it.
Right. Well, hopefully we don't need a big asterisk. We're close enough.
Yeah, so, I think so. What is drought?
Drought, there's no accepted or concise definition of that word. And so it varies from location, but the type of elements that are looked at to saying that you're in a drought obviously is the lack of precipitation. It also goes on to how long you've been below normal. It looks at the moisture that's in your soil moisture, your rivers, your tributaries, how low are they compared to what they would normally be, and what's your snowpack like? So a lot of things go into it, and for measuring that we have a drought. Now, the U.S. Drought Monitor, which takes in consideration of all those factors, does have Northwest California in their designation of calling it a severe drought.
Severe?
They use below normal, you know, abnormal, then a moderate drought, then severe drought, then they also have extreme drought.
Okay. Is that because of the current rain year we're so far off, or
it's partly it's a point in time for them, and so they're looking at the lack of rainfall that we've had from since January. Many places have had only like 30 to maybe 45% of their normal precipitation in the past 12 months. For some, many locations, the calendar year 2013 was a record 12-month period for rainfall for being below normal. So they've looked at that. They've looked at
so a drought is relative then.
Yes,
you can still be in a damp area, but be in drought conditions if you're not getting what you're supposed to be getting.
If you're not getting, and well, also look at your soil moisture and how and the plants, the crops, are they how well are they doing? So it's a combination of things that go in there, and so. One place's drought may not be quite a drought, or at least not as severe a drought as another place.
That would stand to reason, certainly.
So we've had a lot of impacts around the area on our drought. There are the streams are lower, and that's impacting the return of the salmon up the streams. They aren't able to go as far. Those who rely on groundwater, many of them have had to arrange to try and deepen their wells because groundwater's aquifers are lowering, getting lower. I guess the greatest impact so far is in Mendocino County. The county there declared a kind of a drought emergency, partly because the Russian River was so low and Lake Mendocino was so low. They're concerned about their water supply, just for the vineyards, agriculture, but also for household use, the industrial use.
Now that'll be an interesting, I think somebody from the water district will be in a week or so to talk about, because we've talked in the past about the illegal pulls out of the rivers for the marijuana grows.
Right.
So if stream levels and lake levels are part of this drought, or part of the elements that lead to the definition of a drought existing, I wonder how much of it is accurate, how much of it might be artificial because of some of, and I've been told they take huge amounts of water, so I have no idea directly, but if there's enough of that going on, wouldn't that be weird?
Yes.
Huh. Another random thought floats through my head. Huh?
I can't relate to how much of that is.
So you mentioned, Reg, that the amount of moisture in the soil. Now, I know the Forest Service, when they are figuring out the fire weather, they've got a read, and on one side, two different materials, and when one dries out to a certain point, the needle literally bends over to a certain point, and that's how they determine the fire weather danger. Something similar to that with the soil moisture content, or how do they measure this, the content?
Some of it's done can be done by satellite. Others areas have sensors that go down maybe a meter, maybe 2-3 meters, and try to and get a sense of how moist that soil is. And I don't know what necessary criteria they're using, but to make a determination. But that's
so heavy
how
fog
it's
or mist isn't going to really have much impact
deep,
at all.
No.
Yeah, I kind of figure that, or even a good watering for most of our definitions.
No.
You know, let the sprinkler go for an hour and a half, and you know the street's pretty well irrigated. Nothing else is.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's kind of what's happening with the rain we're getting the past few days. It's getting the very top part of the soil wet. It may seep down a bit, but it's not really going to do too much to anything else. We may get some heavier rain Saturday, which is going to cause maybe the Smith to rise and a little bit, but some of the other rivers aren't going to see too much of a response.
Are you climbing out on that limb there, buddy? We all heard that one. Boy, yeah. That'll be a lead on the news tomorrow. KINS, News and Information Times, 343. We'll be back with more from Reg Kennedy.
Sacred Heart Church invites you to join us every Sunday for our liturgical celebrations. Saturday, 4 p.m. Confessions. 5 p.m. Sunday's Vigil Mass. 7 p.m. Spanish Mass, and on Sundays, 9:30 Morning Mass and 12:30 Spanish Mass. Come and celebrate with us.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 346. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Reg Kennedy. Reg, if the concept of drought is kind of tough, when you're looking at all the different terminology that you guys play with, whether it's in the traditional forecasts that we'll hear each day, or whether it's in some of the long range stuff that we really don't have much exposure to, are the terminologies pretty well set, or I know you're gonna love this, or are they kind of fluid?
Well, as we look at it, the different factors that are making our forecast, the word drought doesn't have a accepted concise definition because it can vary across the country or an area of the world. But some of the other terms,
how about normal?
We use are fairly well accepted. If we say the average temperature or normal temperature or normal precipitation, that's a pretty much accepted term throughout the meteorological community. We generally define, before we can talk about a normal or an average, we generally like to have 30 years, a 30 years of period of record. And so that's a standard number. And so other than that, that's accepted.
What about those communities that are, they've been around longer than us? We got 250, 300 years underneath their belt of measuring. Do they have less wiggle in the norms, or less deviation, I guess, in what the norm is, and whether it's unseasonably hot, cold, windy, wet, that kind of stuff, than some of those communities that haven't been settled for that length of time?
No, I wouldn't say they have less wiggle. You just have a larger period of record. So if you're looking back at 100 years and you're saying, well, we had a very warm summer of let's say 10 degrees above a normal for the 3 months of summer, and you only go back 30 years, maybe that's never, you say, well, that's never really occurred. But if you were to go back to your record of 100 years, you can say, yes, that's occurred once or twice during our 100 years. So that's kind of where the longer the period of record is that you can use to see whether a situation, a phenomenon that you had during a season was that far from what's never occurred or occurs maybe once every 20 years or 30 years.
You ever wonder, it sounds like Andy Rooney, they talk about 100-year floods, 500-year floods, 200-year floods, things of that nature. To be able to have the history and really know if it was a 250-year flood cycle and about once every 250 for a couple thousand years, wouldn't it be cool to have that kind of record? And I know some will argue that geologically it's there, but maybe it is, maybe it's not. I know the record-keeping stuff. Is it as tight today as what you would like it to be? All the detail, is it tracked that closely?
I would say for the most part, yes.
Perfect answer for a perfect length of time. Thanks for coming by, Reg.
Okay.
We've been talking shop this afternoon with Reg Kennedy. Join us tomorrow afternoon for more Talk Shop. Till then, go out and make it a good day. Hug someone you love. See you tomorrow.